Don't make me turn this podcast around. You're listening to the Reno Dads Podcast. We're dads talking about dad stuff. We're doing the dad thing in the biggest little city in the world, Reno, Nevada. But we're talking about things that all dads and parents can relate to. We'll share fatherly war stories, discuss manly things, and even get into the tender moments of fatherhood. We want you to be a part of the conversation, so join us and listen in. Oh, and be warned, dad jokes ahead. All right, welcome to the next episode of the Reno Dads Podcast. We have some special guests in the studio with me this week, and really excited to hear about this new exhibit that's been at the Nevada Museum of Art. So I've got Colin and Rebecca. And Colin, why don't you tell us a little about yourself and tell us a little bit, you know, and we can get introduced.
Sure thing. Thanks so much, Jonathan. My name is Colin Robertson, and I am the Senior Vice President of Education and Research at the Nevada Museum of Art, and I have just been back about 4 months. I had been there for about 11 years prior, but took a tour of the private sector and state government, and just been back about 4 months at the time that this exhibition, The Ghost Army, opened up.
Nice. And Rebecca, what's your role?
Yeah, I am the Director of Communications and Marketing at the Nevada Museum of Art. I have been with the museum for a bit over a year, and for the entire duration of Ghost Army, so I'm actually really excited to talk about this exhibition with you.
Yeah, so what is this exhibition? I mean, I've seen it advertised, I've seen the signs up at the, at the front there.
It's a great show, and it's great that you're taking the time to cover it here, Jonathan. Thank you. We are really excited about it because it's a great partnership between the Nevada Museum of Art and the World War II Museum in Louisiana. And that museum has done some tremendous work kind of revitalizing the history of World War II for all kinds of different battles and so forth. But this particular exhibition is really, from my point of view, about why you want an artist on your side in war.
And
what it consists of is a bunch of ephemera and some artwork objects, as well as a variety of different historical objects and items that details the story of a group of 1,100 people who participated in what became known as the Ghost Army. But they were understood as a kind of deception unit in World War II that did some tremendous things, not the least of which was help save somewhere north of 15,000, perhaps as many as 30,000 lives on the battlefield in the European theater. And they did so through deception and trickery, basically.
Subterfuge.
Yeah. So they disguised themselves as different entities within the war on the front lines, and used sound and visual art techniques of a variety of different sorts to trick the German army into believing that they represented two full divisions, 20,000 troops.
And these so 1,100 people looking like 20,000.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Or sounding like 20,000.
Or appearing like they might be much more than they actually were. That's the exciting part of this show, I think. And it's been a ton of fun, and it's just brought people out of the woodwork.
Well, I imagine it. I mean, from my standpoint, I was the first time I saw the, I think it was online somewhere, you guys were starting to promote it. And I was like, okay, how is this related to the art world? And so maybe, you know, people probably have that same question. Like, how is this related to, you know, the Nevada Museum of Art? Well, the mission, and also, like, I know you know, we were thinking about it as artists.
Mm-hmm. Well, many of the men who were recruited to be in the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, which is what they were called, were en route to careers in the arts, were in art school. That's certainly true for Ellsworth Kelly, who was one of the members of the Ghost Army who later became a very famous American modernist. The reason why they were recruiting these guys was A, creativity and sort of thinking out of the box, but then also they had visual acuity in ways that others might not. So a lot of the camouflage deception, for instance, creating these huge visual tableaus using inflatable tanks, artillery units and planes. They would use...
Were they specially recruited because they were artists?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. So somebody up in the higher commands had this like vision of this idea of deception, and this was the unit that was going to do that.
Correct.
There had been a special unit in the British Armed Forces that had begun exploring ideas about deception and fakery, basically faking people out on the battlefield. And this was the first effort really to do so in war. And the American unit of the Ghost Army did, they basically went through basic training and they had nothing more than a 50 caliber machine gun on them within 400 yards of the front line. But what they went through and did was essentially deceive the German front with acoustic deception tactics, like recording sounds of bulldozers moving across a piece of land and amplifying that with these giant speakers
that so they would sound like tanks.
Sound like correct. Tanks.
Yeah.
Or they would make these incredible inflated tanks and aircraft that they put out on the fields of farmers' fields to deceive the reconnaissance folks in the German front, thinking that there were many, many more people on the front line than there actually were. So that meanwhile, other units and other divisions were able to move around the flanks.
Interesting. Okay. And so this wasn't, I mean, it wasn't something that just kind of happened. It was that the British had started this idea and we kind of picked it up and ran with it.
Correct. Sure. And you know, think about the Trojan War, right?
It's I'm thinking
deception
about it,
is as old as warfare, basically. Yeah. But this was a new set of tactics that this unit was recruited specifically to deceive people.
Well, and new technologies also. I mean, you mentioned the recordings, but they were... was actually like the first multi-track recordings because they would, as Colin mentioned, use bulldozers to sound like tanks, but then they would record men talking and laughing and the sounds of building, and they would layer these sounds.
Okay, so I'm really into the sound part of this because I do this podcast thing. I've got my technical thing and I can put like layers together. That's really amazing.
And they would put them on wire recorders. So I didn't know that existed either, but it was like 2 miles of wire would have about 30 minutes of sound, I think. And the reason being that, you know, records would skip, and so that would give up the ruse. And so they would play this on wire recorders on these 500-pound speakers on the back of trucks, like, into the night.
They would create costumes, basically, that were deceiving the communities that they traveled through into believing that they were one unit or another. So the artists would create patches of a given unit and sew them onto their uniforms and sort of play up who they might be from another division, for example, or take over a storefront and decorate it like it was headquarters for a given unit in a small
community. It's just amazing. I mean, the concept of it is obviously, like you said, sort of goes back, you know, forever, right? The Trojan horse idea. But also, try to imagine that age of warfare, which, I mean, is, you know, I'm sure horrific in some respects, but also, like, kind of quaint compared to what we have today, right? I mean, what we're dealing with today, I don't think this same sort of subterfuge would work in the same way, except to say that, I mean, maybe it could in some respects. You know, obviously we had, you know, the U-2 reconnaissance planes that came, you know, all the things that we were able to do and, you know, the Cold War since, you know. But I'm sure, you know, we might have thought that the Russians were doing more when they were doing some of their deception when we were flying over things like, you know, kind of getting, you know, reconnaissance over, you know, Cuba or whatever.
Well, what's interesting is that, for example, these artists made like inflatable replicas of Piper Cubs that were used on the battlefield for reconnaissance purposes. And in some cases, other units, reconnaissance planes, landed in the fields thinking that their buddies were on the ground when it was in fact this deception unit that no one knew about. Even our own side didn't know that this deception unit existed. And so, because they were playing up, that they were performing roles as dramatists, as other
generals. It feels like a big set design. It feels like I'm also sort of thinking about like my obsession with, you know, Broadway musicals, whatever, but I'm like, it feels like a big set design to me.
But if you look at some of the stuff, if you search Twitter, for example, you'll see that Ukraine is currently using similar deception techniques with inflatable tanks that are a little bit more sophisticated than these were, but inflatable
but
tanks
concept,
to, you know, to essentially trick the Russian army into thinking that
oh, that's fascinating.
They are where they're not.
So it's maybe not as quaint as I was thinking.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And what about I know before we started recording here, we were talking a little bit about the sort of Nevada connections. So what are some of those that people might be interested to hear about?
So there's a couple of veterans or members of the Ghost Army that were from Nevada. One of them is Bill Tompkins. We have his little, he kept a small journal when he was on the front, which was not something you were supposed to do, but it's this tiny little address book that he wrote in, this minuscule handwriting about his experiences on the front. He was friends with also Bill Blass, of course, the fashion designer who was a member of the Ghost Army. So he's one example. So
did he design the the uniforms and the patches? Well, and it's Bill Blass. That's hilarious.
It's so funny you bring that. I mean, because part of the exhibition shows the artwork that these soldiers did when they weren't, you know, on duty. When they were off duty, they would often sketch landscapes and whatnot. And Bill Blass hilariously was sketching women's fashion on the front. Seriously, he was. That's part of what we have.
And that's actually where his logo came from. Is that right?
Yes, oh, wow. The two B's. So anyway, Bill Tompkins, we've got his journal. You can actually see it. His mom later would type it up and transcribe it. So we have also the narrative there, because I look at that and it'd be very difficult to read. Also, we have a member of the Ghost Army who was one of the few who took fire the one time that they did encounter the Germans on the front. When he was recovering in Paris from his wounds, Pablo Picasso came by, gave him an art lesson, you know, to the people recovering there. And he did a painting inspired by his experiences on the front of a soldier with fearful eyes going out to the front. And it's done in sort of a Cubist style. And you can see that painting as well. This particular soldier retired in Las Vegas. So there are a couple of serious Nevada connections.
It's such a great story, too, because it's just, there were only 1,100 people in the Ghost Army all together. And they were, in some cases, less than a quarter of a mile from the front line. And in the end, only 3 of them were killed in action, and only 30 experienced any kind of casualty in the form of an injury. But they arguably saved 15,000 to 30,000 lives on the front lines by deceiving the enemy.
Right.
And that really becomes a kind of...
It's a force multiplier in a way.
It's a force multiplier, and it's the reason that you kind of want that artist on your side in war, I think.
Yeah. It's an interesting story to tell. I mean, and especially with respect to what we would expect to see in an art museum, right? We don't expect to see... I mean, certainly art about war is... I mean, there are many, many examples of that. But this example of a unit that is, you know, being highlighted here at an art museum is really sort of of a special thing. How did you guys come across it, or how did they decide to come to Nevada? Do you remember how that happened?
It was organized by the World War II Museum. Mm-hmm. And so the World War II Museum is primarily a history museum, obviously. But this exhibition, because of its connection to the sort of art and design of war in a way, is really the fit for the Nevada Museum of Art in a lot of respects. But it's also been, you know, part of our goal as an institution is to provide many different kinds of experiences of art and design for our audience segments here in Northern Nevada and across the state, really. And this is one of those ways that has really helped to just bring people out of the woodwork. And
well, I'm going to just go back in a little ways, because I remember meeting you, Colin, you know, when you were first at the museum, and you told me, and I think it was you who told me about the Seven Magic Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to go back in the archive for myself. I went to go see that the week it opened, 2 weeks after it opened, because I'd heard about it. I happened to be on a road trip. I was like, I'm going to go experience this art that, you know, I had learned about from you, or somebody was connected to the art museum at the time. And I have to say, look, it was a really powerful experience. And seeing the way the museum has, like, a pretty wide view of what art is and how it impacts, you know, humans, right? I mean, what we see and what we experience with art, you know, and the way we can experience it, and then the impact it can have on your life. I mean, that's a huge, you know, I mean, to me, I mean, it was very impactful. And then I'll fast forward a couple of years later, I was on a reverse road trip with my kids, and I dragged them, you know, like, you guys want to go see this? And they were blown away by it too. And it's still, you know, standing out there in the desert. And I have to say, that was, you know, really just a wonderful experience to have on my own as a solo sort of, you know, road tripper. And then to, you know, bring my kids through to see it for their first time. And I it's one of the things that I always tell people, like, if you're in Vegas, like, get away from the strip for a little bit and go check this thing out.
It's definitely worth it. It's, it's a new chapter in the history of land art. It's sort of like a contemporary chapter in the history of land art. Mm-hmm. And Ugo Rononone has been a great partner, the artist who created that work, and a great partner to the museum. But that piece, Seven Magic Mountains, is still visited by almost 1,100 people every single day. And it is a tremendous kind of icon of Nevada now from a kind of public art standpoint, but really just wonderful. And a great partnership with the University of Nevada, Reno, and their At One studio, particularly with Lucas Starmer, has been creating a digital, like a virtual reality experience of Seven Magic Mountains that's been really tremendous.
And oh, that's interesting.
Looking
too,
to bring that out to the public.
Well, I will recommend to folks to go see it, and I'll say, you know, take a look and see when sunrise is that day and plan your visit accordingly. Like, be there before sunrise and wait for the sunrise, you know, and I will tell you it is a magical experience.
Yeah.
So,
it is.
So thank you for that, by the way, for, you know, what the Nevada Museum of Art has brought to my life personally. I mean, I'll just say that was a really special thing for me. What's left on this exhibit? How long is it going to be with us, and when people can come see it?
The timing of this conversation is great because we've got about 3 more weeks of the Ghost Army exhibition to see. We've got a great talk coming up about deception in World War II on July 13th. That's a Thursday night. But next Thursday is First Thursday, and that'll be a great party with live music at the museum as every Thursday. And then following that on July 8th, we'll have Second Saturday, which will be the free family day that has been a long time fixture in the community. And people come out of the woodwork to make art with their kids and see some interesting things on display at the museum, but also listen to a story or take an art expedition through the galleries with a gallery educator. Then towards the end of the run of the exhibition, we've got an art bite on Friday, July 21st at noon, which is one of our education staff leaders who, Megan, is going to be doing a talk about the fashion of the World War II era that she kind of is reprising from a really successful talk earlier in the run of the exhibition. But sort of at the same time, we've got some really great artwork by an under-recognized woman artist from the middle of the 20th century, Adeline Kent. And that's an exhibition that the Nevada Museum of Art organized. And it's led by our senior curator of contemporary art, Apsara DeQuinzio. And that exhibition really kind of brought back to life the career and history and the work of Adeline Kent, who was an important mid-century modern artist who has been largely forgotten. And her work, Apsara's work to reprise the history of her artwork has been really valuable and really important, but it's very much about the Sierra Nevada mountains and the experience of a modernist artist in the Sierra in the 1950s and 60s especially.
Oh,
so it's definitely worth checking out because that'll close shortly, or very close to the same time as the Ghost Army.
And what else is on the roadmap, you know, coming up in the next couple of weeks and months?
We will have a couple of exhibitions opening up on August 26th. Really diverse artists, actually. One of them, Guillermo Burt, is originally from Santiago, Chile, but immigrated to the United States and currently resides in Los Angeles. A lot of his work deals with the narratives around immigration and what it means to move from place to place. He's interested in articulating these stories through installations that are really immersive. So he has one that's a series of laser cut, what he calls his warriors, but they're really frontline workers that kept the economy going during COVID-19. So you'll be surrounded by these frontline workers. And as a result of being surrounded by mirrors as well, the audience becomes a part of the installation. We'll also have an artist named April Bay, who is interested in a topic called Afrofuturisms, essentially rethinking you know, race and identity, and all these kinds of ways through the lens of speculative and science fiction. So another immersive installation where you'll be surrounded by...
I saw something either at the, maybe at the Met or at MoMA back in New York about, there might have been mm-hmm. some other exhibit.
MoMA did a great show about sort of a survey of Afrofuturism. Yeah. And April Bay is a really remarkable young artist in that area. But it's really exciting because it's about a way to kind of help people across a wide variety of audience segments kind of wrestle with how, you know, when we think of speculative fiction, science fiction, it's really about trying to imagine alternative futures, mm-hmm. right? And that's really kind of where Afrofuturism has really created a rich and robust kind of body of work in both visual art, design, literature, television, you name it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really an interesting and powerful way to kind of understand how people are imagining what might be possible and what might have been.
What might have been possible, right? Well,
and it's interesting, too, with her work, the idea for creating these worlds, the universe she creates is called Atlantica, comes from her childhood. She came home from school one day and asked her father, you know, why are people treating me differently? Like, she's black, and the other students were not. And he said, well, that's because you're from another planet. And he told her this story about, you know, you're here to observe these things and to judge whether or not, you know, and to make them, to make decisions on your own about them. And so that narrative is sort of carried over into her work. So in really interesting ways.
October, we got definitely hit on an artist named Chanupa Hanska Luger, who is a really remarkable emerging artist, but who's become very well known in the last couple of years because his work was recognized as part of the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And he has just done some remarkable work about sort of contemporary expressions of indigenous identity, but also a kind of indigenous idea of futurism that he calls
future ancestral technologies,
which are kind of trying to think about how to deploy ancestral knowledge in a contemporary context.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I'm excited to see those come up on the calendar. And I know it's funny. I mean, I'm a kind of dad where I drag my kids to these things, and then when they were little, it was, you know, dragging them. Now I'm happy to say that all of that sort of effort is paid off, right? Because my kids now, at least to my face anyway, they don't protest as much when I say, hey, let's go check out this museum. Let's go, you know, kind of explore these, you know, things. And if I take them to, you know, a play, or if I take them to an exhibit, or we, you know, sort of, you know, include that in our itinerary whenever we go back to New York, for example, to go visit my sister, it's always on the itinerary, right? Yeah. Hey, we're going to go stop by and hit, you know, one of these museums. And they certainly, I feel like as they've gotten older, you know, so it's worth the effort when your kids are little to go and, you know, find these exhibits. Maybe you'll learn something yourself. You'll learn alongside your kids, which is another great way to experience these things. I'm sure there are a lot of things that, you know, are so educational, obviously, at the, you know, Nevada Museum of Art.
Well, and Jonathan, you know, all three of my kids who basically grew up in the museum, but Lucy, our youngest daughter, is sort of the measure of our relationship because she was born 2 weeks before you moved to town. And now she's seven, but she comes to the museum with me regularly, and so do Tate and Auden. And they, you know, that kind of visitor is, it's really just sort of planting a seed, hopefully, right? Like, my kids get bored at the museum after a little bit sometimes too, but they come, they enjoy making an artwork and part of a second Saturday event, for example, and we look at something for a few minutes and then we move on. But you plant that seed and try to make something like a museum and the exposure to the art and art history that our museum is able to provide. And you hope that that's going to be something that will take root with your children and become part of their lives as they grow up and fledge the nest.
Yeah, I mean, I do recall, actually, you said that. I'm coming up on 8 years here in Reno. I mark the time as, you know, when's the next hot August nights, which is when I landed here in Reno, which was quite its own sort of like, oh, wow, that happens here in Reno. Okay. But also, we have the Nevada Museum of Art. So we have, you know, hot August nights, which is its own sort of category of event. And now we have the expanding Nevada Museum of Art. I know there's a lot of excitement going on around that. We'll leave that to another time to check in as that progresses, because I'm excited to see where that goes too.
It's a good sized hole right now, but there will be some vertical elements coming out of the ground by the end of the summer.
That's exciting to hear. Yeah. So you guys, thanks so much for coming in. I'm really excited to go check it out myself, and I hope a lot of our listeners will do the same. Anything else before we close off?
Thanks so much for inviting us, and good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you guys too. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Reno Dads podcast on renodads.com. Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you. Stop by renodads.com and click on Contact Us and let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear on our show. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook,